First you told Sony that you could wean old God, and if we dared to question, then he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. And now you build your fences and you say there's nothing we can do. Say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores.
Welcome to Corporations and Democracy. From the Philo Studio, I'm your host, Linda McClure. Our guest today is Antonia Juhas. She's an award-winning energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist specializing in oil. Her articles appear in Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, Ms. Magazine, The Washington Post, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Advocate, and many other publications. She's the author of three books, Black Tide, The Tyranny of Oil, and The Bush Agenda. She's appeared on many TV and radio broadcasts, and we are so fortunate to have Antonia on the show with us this morning. I also want to acknowledge Corporation Democracy co-host Annie and Steve, Annie Esposito and Steve Scalmanini, who have the second Friday of the month. Steve introduced me to Antonia and facilitated her being on the show today. So want to give a shout out to Steve for that. Let me bring Antonia up here. Hi, Antonia.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me on the show. Good morning.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your education and your path toward the travel and the work you've done around oil.
Sure. So I'm joining you today from my home in San Francisco. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I studied public policy in undergraduate and graduate schools and worked focused on issues related to women and public policy related to addressing inequality and poverty, particularly that affecting women, and worked then went to work on Capitol Hill for a time in the congressional offices of Elijah Cummings and John Conyers Jr., with a focus on public policy related to addressing inequality. And that then stretched into looking at what was hampering, from my perspective, our ability to implement the policies that our constituents who were, these districts were Baltimore and Detroit, so areas with a very large low-income population, a large population of low-income women, low-income women of color, and what did I see was most hindering our ability to implement the policies that would most help our constituents. And as it came as a surprise to me as a young, I guess, somewhat naive legislative assistant working in Washington, D.C., that it was the role of corporations in really influencing government decision, and not my offices in particular, but the institution as a whole, that I really came to see as the biggest problem. So, appearing as a guest on the show, Corporations and Democracy, is a good fit for me. So I left the Hill and started looking at this issue of corporate power and how to address its influence, and basically went right to the top of the food chain, which was the oil industry, and started looking increasingly in my investigations and my work on what was the makeup of this industry, what was the policies that it was having most influence on, obviously not just looking anymore at this point on the most domestic issues, but national and international policy making. I'm jumping quickly through a lot of years, but basically we jump forward to the Bush administration, and that's where we see, at least at that point, at what has been just about at that time in modern history, a pinnacle of relations between the oil industry and a U.S. government dramatically influencing public policy decisions. And I had been writing articles. I had worked in advocacy organizations, but at that point I started writing books. And I wrote my first book, The Bush Agenda, looking at the relationships of different corporations in the Bush administration, and in particular, the decision to invade Iraq and then the trajectory that that war took. The next book I wrote was entitled The Tyranny of Oil, really providing what I had felt had been missing for many decades, which was a deep dive look at this relationship between the oil industry and in particular U.S. government policy making, and providing a history of the industry and then a look forward. And at that point, I started being asked to do a lot more investigative work and investigative journalism. I started doing much more of that. I then wrote my third book, which is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, where I spent a great deal of time on the ground looking at the impacts of the BP oil spill. Continued to do that, went on to do a fellowship in investigative journalism at UC Berkeley, and then began writing articles, really, which took me around the world looking at the role of oil and policy making, writing for Rolling Stone, Newsweek, Harper's, you named the outlets, and have continued to do that work ever since, which has really brought me to the front lines of looking at the impacts of oil and fossil fuel extraction, the people who are most impacted by it, the companies that are making decisions around it, how it influences public policy, and also the rise of incredible resistance movements, really. And this isn't something new. As I've tracked the history of the industry, basically wherever the oil industry has ever operated, there have been people who have tried to organize to either hold it to greater account for its operations or get it removed from where they live altogether. But really seeing, particularly in the face of climate change, a marked dramatic increase in local, national, and international movements to really rein in or remove altogether the oil industry. And I think that takes us probably well to today.
I, through all that, I was thinking, how do you cope? I mean, this is pretty depressing stuff. How do you carry on?
I think that's probably a question that anyone could be asked at this point in modern history. It's a lot of depressing stuff, to be sure, in happening at this time. And, you know, for me, it's very, very satisfying to do work that I find very important. I think it's, I'm telling stories that I believe need to be told, doing investigations that need to be investigated, and sharing that information to the best of my abilities. And there's a lot of satisfaction and support in that. And also, you know, I have to say I'm just really inspired everywhere I go by the people that are, you know, facing far worse circumstances than I am, and are able to organize for what's right every single day and to overcome far worse obstacles than I face just, you know, coming into a place where there is an oil spill, such as the BP oil spill, or where there's a war, such as Afghanistan, and come in, spend some time, and report about it is obviously dramatically different than living it, and being someone who lives through it, faces the hardship day after day, and also stands up to demand accountability and change and reform. You know, that gives me incredible inspiration and hope.
Yeah, people do offer hope. So
that's right.
Let's talk about your recent article last month in the LA Times. In that article, you point out that Richard Nixon established a goal of energy independence, and Donald Trump claims a goal of American energy dominance. So if you could explain the difference between those two goals and the ramifications of them.
Sure. So this was a actually an opinion editorial that I wrote for the Los Angeles Times that came out in December, and it's called Trump's Pursuit of American Energy Dominance Threatens the Entire Planet. And I wrote it because I felt it was really important to walk through, you know, we talk about the Trump administration in many ways, and one of the ways we talk about it is somewhat bumbling. You know, the Trump administration sort of falling, or Trump himself falling from place to place, losing members of his cabinet, being in chaos, which is true. But what is also true is that the administration has been very successful in pursuing many of its core objectives. And I thought it was very important to lay out what that objective is for the Trump administration, how it's implementing it, and how it's been successful. So just quickly to say, I think the Trump administration has been very successful in three areas of its agenda. In its agenda on immigration, it's been very successful at making the United States an anti-immigrant nation from a policy perspective. It's also been very successful in its deregulatory agenda, and the tax bill was remarkably successful in shifting an enormous amount of wealth to the wealthiest Americans and removing wealth from the rest of us and corporations. And then the third place, and these are not mutually exclusive because the deregulatory agenda is very much a part of the third area, is in the fossil fuel area, where the administration has been incredibly successful at servicing and serving the fossil fuel industry and many of its corporate backers who are in the fossil fuel industry, and many of its cabinet members, current cabinet members, who still continue to be in service to that industry. And that difference that you lay out at the very beginning is really key, because it's basically been the stated policy position of every U.S. president since Nixon, that the United States sought to be energy independent, meaning we would produce enough. Really, the intent of that was gasoline, but it's also just energy, that we wouldn't need to import oil from other countries or energy sources from other countries. Instead, we'd be independent. What Trump did was shift that as part of his overall America First agenda into what he declared to be the pursuit of American energy dominance. And that means not just being a country that produces enough fuels for ourselves and our own need, but basically joining the club of Russia and Saudi Arabia and being a global powerhouse on producing so much that we joined that club. And in fact, members of the Trump administration and advisors to the Trump administration went further and said that they really wanted to see the United States surpass those nations in its ability to control oil. And that the Trump administration did then, in a very organized fashion, from the very first days of being in office, move forward to change public policy to enable a massive, untethered increase in production of oil, natural gas, and coal across the United States.
And what are some of the specific, I know in your article you go after point of what Trump's administration has accomplished. What do you think are some of the more serious ones?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. And so I would say, you know, I would start at the beginning and say just 4 days after the inauguration, Trump fast-tracked the completion of the Dakota Access oil pipeline. And that was a pipeline, of course, about which there was enormous resistance on the ground, led by Native Americans and supported by allies and Native American tribes from across the United States and across and tribes from across the world, indigenous tribes from across the world, joined in and supported a resistance camp that literally set itself up to blockade completion of that pipeline. And they were nearly successful, actually, under the Obama administration, which had told its agencies to conduct a new analysis to see if there was a different route that the pipeline could take, or if it was even okay for it to be completed at all. And the Trump administration came in and said, you know, we're just going to finish this thing. The completion of that pipeline was, one, a statement. You know, we're not taking other concerns into account. And really opened up a faucet of new oil production coming out of North Dakota, which increased dramatically after the pipeline was built. And in fact, it increased so much that they're now saying in North Dakota that they need another pipeline because they're producing so much oil there now, reaching their highest daily production in the state's history, that the Dakota Access Pipeline isn't enough and they're going to need another pipeline. But that was just one policy at the very beginning. So one of the things that the administration did was rescind several key executive orders that the Obama administration had put into place, including the Clean Power Plan, which I think has gotten a lot of attention, but also a presidential order that was very important that was called Preparing the United States for the Impacts of Climate Change. And we wouldn't be doing that anymore under the Trump administration because that was rescinded within the first days of office. Another one on mitigating the impacts on natural resources from the development of oil and natural gas. That was rescinded within the first couple days. But then there was changes that I think are less well-known and very important. So the Trump administration at the Department of Interior shifted, let me make sure I get this language exactly right, excuse me, because I don't want to say it wrong. The Interior Department changed its oil and gas leasing policy to limit public comment and environmental reviews and accelerate permitting and expand leasing. And what that did was make 6 times the amount of public land available to oil and gas leasing compared to just 2 years ago, resulting in the number of oil and natural gas wells on lands administered by the federal government to increase by 85% between 2016 to 2017. Now, that most impacted state where I'm from, Colorado, also New Mexico, Utah, Wyoming, and just greatly expanded, accelerated permitting, accelerated production. And in fact, the Bureau of Land Management, one of the people who work for it said that representing New Mexico, admitted that not only is there this vast expansion of operations, but that his team doesn't even have the resources to enforce the rules on the books that remain to reduce violations from things like oil spills and poor environmental management. And that's on top of the other thing that one of the other things the Trump administration did, which was to basically put a freeze altogether on as much as possible on regulation and the ability of the federal government to enforce regulations. So across federal agencies, within the first 6 months, nearly 300 federal regulations specifically related to energy production and environmental protection were rescinded, withdrawn, or otherwise stalled by 2017. And Trump also then put in this order which said, if you do implement a new regulation, you have to rescind two, which is just a crazy way, of course, of operating the regulatory capacity of the government. And so what this has created is an environment in which there's more production with less regulation. And the result has been the United States surpassing all previous records on domestic production of oil, domestic production of natural gas, and reversing what has been a decline in the production of coal, and for the first time seeing an increase in production in coal in several years, because the Obama administration had actually implemented a moratorium on any new coal leasing on public land, which the Trump administration removed. And then we saw an increase, as I said, for the first time in several years in U.S. production of coal. We're also exporting these products at record amounts, but we're not energy independent. We're still importing oil and natural gas as well. I could go on and on, which is why I wrote the article, but there's just trying to put out a lot of evidence there of really significant policy changes that have served to dramatically expand oil, natural gas, and coal production in the United States while regulating it significantly less.
Great. You are listening to Corporations and Democracy on KCYX and Z. Our guest today is Antonia Juhas. She's an award-winning energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist specializing in oil. I'm your host, Linda McClure. So you've gone over some of the major things or some of the few of the many things that the Trump administration has been working on. What is the process of the deregulation, and are there obstacles to the implementation of these policies that they're doing? How long does it take, and are there ways to stop it on the track?
Yeah, so there's been a very strong pushback, of course. There's been lawsuits, there's been organizing, and many more regulations would have disappeared had it not been for a very concerted pushback, particularly lawsuits challenging the illegality of many of these operations and decisions to remove regulations. And that has been successful. I think there is also, attempts to put in place new regulations and to not only put back in regulations that were in place that were removed, but also to take on an entirely different approach to how we address the production of fossil fuels in the United States. And I think the other thing to say that I didn't say is the other piece of the op-ed is, this, of course, isn't just about production in the United States. So the other thing that's happened is, of course, the Trump administration is very closely aligned to the Putin regime. And we could obviously spend hours talking about that. Of course, today, Roger Stone just arrested, and the indictment claims that Russian intelligence leaked the Clinton and Democratic campaign emails to WikiLeaks, which then coordinated through Roger Stone with the Trump campaign to strategically release those emails in a way that would cause the most damage to the Clinton administration and help the Trump administration win the election. That's obviously just one bit of news in the Mueller investigation, which is shining obviously increased light on what the exact relationship was with the Trump campaign and the Russians, but we certainly know that there is a long relationship between, or a established relationship, between Donald Trump and Putin. And one of the things that I think is very clearly emerging, even though I said in the beginning that there are advisors to the Trump administration and advisors to his campaign who would like to see the U.S. supersede Russia and Saudi Arabia in its oil dominant role, what is taking shape instead is a new alliance between these three nations, the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, to create a brand new oil bloc, with the intent being to push back against all of these efforts, particularly being driven by climate change concerns, to really shift away from fossil fuels, particularly in the way that we acquire energy, and shift to renewable sources of energy, and to push back against that and to aggressively try to maintain fossil fuels in general, but oil in particular, as a dominant not only energy resource, but resource for all sorts of things, including plastics, and the U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia teaming up to achieve that goal. And that each of these three nations are also becoming more autocratic, more isolated in their behavior and also their approach to this resource, and becoming very powerful, the three of them. And obviously and one of the examples that really just came to the forefront was when the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Russia teamed up with Kuwait in Poland at the most recent climate negotiations, which were called the COP24 negotiations, the latest negotiations to move forward on the Paris Climate Accord commitments. They came forward as a bloc and stood in the way of accepting a really critical analysis that warned that we only have 12 years within which to keep global warming down to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, or pass a precipice beyond which stabilizing the climate may not be possible at all. And they rejected that study that was conducted by the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and refused to acknowledge it within the negotiations in Paris, and really just pushed back aggressively in general on moving forward with the global commitment to take action on climate change. So on the question that you started us off with, you know, what can be done and what are people doing? Certainly one of the things that people are doing is working on the global level to really push back against this model and try to lock in concrete commitments to address climate change. And then also on the national level, there's definitely a push for a new perspective on how we address public policy. And I think the best example of that is with the push for a Green New Deal, which is a set of policy, just ideas at this point, not concrete policy. The hope is to shift it into concrete policies that really tackle moving away from fossil fuels altogether and putting in place, a la the New Deal, a whole suite of policies that would shift the U.S. economy to a renewable energy economy with a strong focus on social justice and making sure that the jobs and the income distribution are equal and really support those with the lowest incomes among us or no incomes, and use the Green New Deal as a way to reset the U.S. economy to be one that is not only renewable, but is significantly more just. And I think that really runs. It's definitely the opposite policy approach to the one that we're seeing being pushed by the Trump administration.
All right, we are at 11:33. If listeners would like to call in and get in on the conversation, the number is 895-2448. So you touched on the Green New Deal. What impact do you see the new House members and hopefully next year? We have a phone call. Let's take the caller's question first. Welcome to Corporations and Democracy. You're on the air.
Hi. I love your show. I'm glad you are informing the public in a intelligent fashion about what's going on. But I got a comment, and part of it is about the oil industry. Part of it is about immigration. We have, over the last 30 or 40 years in America, been involved in destabilizing a lot of countries in South America and in Central America. It started with Chile, which was fairly successful, but it's gone on to other countries, and it ends up making their countries very difficult to live in, if not dangerous, which results in all the immigration we have. Now, what I see is we're pointing toward a possible invasion and or destabilization influence in Venezuela. We have had years of, I forget what you call it, but blocking economically their success, and now we're supporting the election of a different president who will, if he's successful, then probably it will result in another civil war in that country. The whole point is to try to control whatever oil is coming out of that country. And that seems to be the thrust of all of our influence in all countries that we get involved in this manner. And, of course, it results in death and destruction in those countries. We really need to focus not on oil or natural gas, but like you said, renewable energy. So the Green New Deal, I applaud. I hope that Ocasio-Cortez and a lot of the other people who are involved in this will help wake up Congress and try to move out of the oil industry and into renewables, because we really need it. The planet needs it. Our children need it. Our grandchildren need it. So that's kind of the thrust of what I was thinking. And I'd love to have your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, yeah, thank you. What a great comment. Thank you so much for that. Yes, so important to talk about Venezuela right now, and we could talk for an hour about Venezuela. And Venezuela is one of the world's largest oil producers, has one of the largest oil reserves in the world, and definitely a country that the United States has long meddled in its affairs, dramatically meddled in its affairs, and I would argue, as your caller did, that oil is at the heart of that. And certainly, and I really appreciate you making this connection, this, of course, impacts immigration. So the policies that the U.S. government has used to destabilize nations across Central and South America, but obviously throughout the world as well, with oil being one of the primary reasons, has led to economies that can't develop as they should, a lack of stability within nations, governments that are not the governments of the people's choosing, and that, of course, leads people to need to leave their nations and immigrate somewhere else. And so the necessity of immigration is also tied into this intimately, and thank you so much for making that point. And that, of course, is also the point, the impact of other places in the world where one of the largest groups of refugees in the world right now are coming from Afghanistan and from Iraq, which are, of course, places where long the locations of U.S. intervention, and of course Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, and Iraq, one of the longest wars in U.S. history,
the Muslim travel ban and immigration issues,
right,
tie in there too.
That's right. And, of course, so the Trump administration trying to bar immigrants at a time when many of the people seeking to come to the United States are seeking to come here because of actions of the U.S. government that made their home country places where they could no longer live, is, of course, one of the many reasons why this immigration policy is such a sham and so detrimental and so harmful to so many people. And I really appreciate the caller making that point. So
let's take another call here.
Yeah, thanks.
Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask your guest a question about subsidies. I recently read that the subsidies for oil, gas, and coal account for 6% of global GDP. Now, the right wing is always talking about how terrible it is to give money for people so they can get food or have a place to live. But I'm surprised I never hear anything about this kind of socialism for these oil companies, and nobody seems to talk about it. And so I'd appreciate any information she could give on that subject. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it. So the U.S. government as well as many other governments around the world, has long directly and aggressively subsidized the fossil fuel industry here. And it's actually an issue that's brought up, I think, regularly, and hopefully you will hear more about it, by groups concerned about the influence of the fossil fuel industry, but also, you know, more conservative organizations that, that dislike, as you say, that type of unnecessary subsidy for this industry. But I don't have the numbers right in front of me. A good organization to look at to get those numbers over the years is Oil Change International. But there's also a campaign in Washington, D.C. called the Green Scissors campaign that's been going on for years and years, and it's different environmental organizations across the country in and exercising their influence in Washington, D.C. to try and raise awareness. And it's called the Green Scissors campaign, meaning let's cut out of the budget all of those subsidies that are not going to green renewable activities and use these green scissors to find the space in the budget for things that need to be more subsidized, like renewable energy efforts, and remove the billions and billions of dollars in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. And that's actually one of the things that the Obama administration did do was increase subsidies to renewable energy, but it did not do the other part, which was reduce the subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. And when you look at those subsidies globally, looking at the European Union as well, it is hundreds of billions of dollars that are used to prop up this industry that also happens to be one of the wealthiest industries in the world. And if there was really a fair footing on the subsidies that were going to renewable energy as compared to those that are going to the fossil fuel sector, you would see the prices for renewable energy be even, you know, far more competitive even than they already are today, which is, it actually shows how incredible and renewable energy has been at moving itself into a place of being competitive with fossil fuels when it is competing on such an uneven platform.
Okay.
So the Green, Green Scissors campaign and Oil Change International to get even more of that data on the exact numbers on fossil fuel subsidies.
And I'm also going to ask you now and at the end of the show to give your contact information. And callers, you can call in 895-2448. So your contact information, if people want to learn more about the wonderful writing that you've done.
Sure. Thank you for asking. The best place to go is my website, which is my name, AntoniaYuhas.net. And I'll spell that just in case your Hungarian isn't up to speed. And my first name is A-N-T-O-N-I-A, then J-U-H-A-S-Z, and that's AntoniaYuhas.net. I'm also on Twitter on that name. I'm also much less so, but somewhat on Facebook under that name. And there's also a contact place there where you can send an email that goes directly to me, that you can reach me there as well.
Great. Thanks so much. 895-2448. So let's talk a little bit more about the new House members and how they can impact what Trump is Trump's administration is trying to do, as well as the hope for the Senate if we get a majority of clear-thinking people in the Senate. How can the Congress impact what Trump's going to do in the last couple of years?
I think, you know, there are many things the Congress can do, and one of the most important things is, as is happening with the Green New Deal, is lay out a concrete policy agenda for what those who want to see a different path on fossil fuels and a different path on climate change and a different path on social justice and equality policy will implement when it's time to. So when and if there is a favorable president and a favorable Senate where new laws can be implemented, what will those laws be? And really mapping them out and taking the time to do deep investigations with that committee authority into what's gone wrong with the policies that we have and what are the policies that are needed to put the U.S. on the right track. And that work that authority that can be used through committees, through investigation, through individual congressional offices in drafting and putting forward legislation doesn't only have to be work that is translated on the federal level. That can also be investigations, policy ideas that can be translated into, for example, lawsuits that stop things that are wrong and policy ideas that support things that are good that can be implemented at the local level, that can be implemented at the state level. This should be a dialogue that's being reinforced between ongoing campaigns that are happening at local level, at state level, at federal level, and policy that needs to be implemented at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level. And it should be a dialogue between constituents, between organizing groups, between policymakers, and between lawyers. So one of the things that the Democrats now have with control of the House is control of very important committees that have the potential for great investigatory power. And this happened during the Bush administration when Democrats controlled the House. Some incredible, the groundwork for incredible information that we only know about the fossil fuel industry, about the war in Iraq, about the activities of the Bush administration only came about because we had aggressive committee chairs who led aggressive investigations, like Senator Levin, like Wyden, who led investigations into these industries. And then the information they got led to lawsuits, led to new policy, led to changes in the way that we approach law, both, again, and I think this is really important to say, it doesn't only have to be federal change, it can also be state change and local change. And that, you know, I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has set the bar really high and ambitious with the idea of a Green New Deal, and I think that's fantastic, and it has the backing of, you know, all of the leading environmental organizations and social justice organizations who now are engaged that this idea was set out, and then how do we turn it into meaningful policy? And I think that's exactly that type of approach is so important right now, particularly when we do have this timeline that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change gave us in its report in June, saying we have 12 years. And it, the most important thing I think that the report also said was we can do this, that this is possible, that the policy changes can be made, the actions can be made to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, but we have to act now, and we have to act rapidly.
And we have another.
That's where the idea of a policy change like the Green New Deal or, the ambition of a Green New Deal is so vital, and I think people want it and are ready for it, particularly if you look at polls on climate change now. The more that climate change directly impacts people, and of course your listeners have been impacted by fire, we've been impacted in San Francisco by the smoke from the fires, the more that people are personally impacted by the effects of climate change, the more they not only acknowledge that it's a real phenomenon, but that we need to take action and that they're ready to take action to address it.
Great. We have another caller. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question, I guess, is towards the future. How do you see, I guess, the military-industrial complex coming together with the oil side? Obviously, they're already kind of attached at the hip. And then do you see fuel prices dropping as we move into an era where we aren't using it as much and that last-ditch effort, how do you see that develop in maybe the next 5 to 10 years? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, caller.
Again, you raised really important issues. So obviously there has been a deep connection between U.S. military policy, the pursuit of oil, and industry, and that's something I write about in the Bush agenda, and that's also something I'm on the advisory committee of a group that was called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and is now called About Faith, and it's veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other wars who have since taken a stand against those wars and against militarism and against war. And one of the central campaigns that they're working on is looking at this relationship between the full military industrial complex, and it's called Drop the Mic, Drop the Military Industrial Complex. And they're doing really important work, particularly coming from the perspective of veterans who have fought in these wars. And I think that the Bush administration in particular, have written extensively on how the Iraq War was a war fought for oil, not exclusively, not the only thing that the war was about. There are other objectives, but it was certainly a central objective and certainly something that was done, I argue, in coordination with the oil industry, which has been a winner of the Iraq War. So where Iraq was closed to U.S. and British oil companies before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it is now dominated with those companies who have partnered with Russian and Chinese companies, and now they have access to this vast, vast source of oil. And I think that, you know, that is something that as long as we maintain oil as this very unique resource that gives nations power, gives them money, gives them influence, makes them the dominant nations in the world, that connection will likely continue, though it changes with administrations, and I think that's something that's very important. The role of the use of the military with an oil agenda is not something that is continuous through administrations. And one thing that has happened with this administration, the Trump administration, is there's one unifying thread to the Trump administration's foreign policy that is a virulent antipathy towards Iran. And I think we still remain at the potential cusp of the threat of military engagement, potentially even more with Iran, because of this administration. And that, too, so the Bush administration, after Iraq, it was very clear the next war was going to be Iran. And then the Bush administration was gone, and the Obama administration did not go to war with Iran. Instead, it negotiated the nuclear deal with Iran. The Trump administration, of course, trashed the nuclear deal and has Bolton, who has made his career to see regime change in Iran. And that is not only about oil, but it is definitely about oil among the things that are on the list. And I think that we have to be very, very, very concerned about and maintain that awareness of the potential threat of military action by this government in and against Iran, and certainly, as I said, oil being a key part of that. So the military-industrial complex continues to be something that we have to look at in respect to oil.
Eisenhower warned us.
Go ahead.
We do have another call, a couple calls, and we don't have too much time. So I'm going to take one more call and ask that we just take a couple minutes on it. So, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, Antonia. I was the one, whenever you came to Ukiah, that failed to record your presentation. But the most important thing that I have to contribute to you, that I would run for president because of your intelligence and your integrity, is the fact that one of the first things that T. Rump did was he appointed the greatest criminal, environmental, global killer as Secretary of State, the head of Exxon, to run this government into the ground. Thank you so much for your work. I love you as a human being, and you're an excellent intelligent delegate for us. Thank you.
Well, see what great listeners have. We really do have a very informed and intelligent listenership. And I would second all of that that he has said.
That was extremely kind. Thank you so much. And yes, the questions have been fantastic, and that was an incredibly a kind comment, so thank you so much for that.
Could you tell us about the event that you're going to be introducing your colleague, Dar Jamal,
in
the Bay Area? Yes, coming
up. That's right, thank you. So that event is coming up on January 31st. I'll be introducing Dar Jamal, who's speaking in Berkeley at the First Congressional Church at 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley at 7:30, again on January 31st. And that's an event at the fundraiser for KPFA, where I had been a co-host for a couple months during the midterm. And that's because the event is being held because Dar has a brand new book that I highly recommend. It's called The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And I encourage folks to go to kpfa.org to learn more about that event. I'll be speaking as well. And yes, Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, who became U.S. Secretary of State under Trump until he was fired, like so many other people, a very important piece in this cause. So I also appreciate our last caller for bringing that up.
Yeah. And can you give us your contact information again?
Sure. It's on my website, antoniajuhas.net, AntoniaJuhasz. Also, you'll find me on Twitter at that address as well.
And Dar will be a guest on Joy LeClaire's show, Forthright Radio, which airs next Wednesday, the 30th, from 11 to noon in this time slot. So you'll be able to hear him, too, and maybe make it to that event. So, Antonia, I so appreciate your being on the show today, taking time out of your extremely busy schedule. Antonia Juhas is an award-winning energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist specializing in oil. So thanks so much for contributing so much good information to our listeners and to corporations and democracy.
Well, thank you, Linda, so much for having me. I really appreciate your interview questions and the time and the questions of the listeners. It was great fun. Thanks for having me.
It's the comments I write up.